From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we conclude our series of interviews with people who worked in the Clinton White House. We'll hear from two former press secretaries. Mike McCurry took over from Dee Dee Myers in 1995. He handled such stories as the government shutdown, the war in Bosnia, and the Monica Lewinsky scandal. When he resigned in 98, his deputy press secretary, Joe Lockhart, took over just in time for the start of the impeachment. Lockhart later dealt with the bombing of Kosovo and the alien Gonzalez story. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews When Somebody Loves You by country singer Alan Jackson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The confirmation hearings of John Ashcroft, the nominee for U.S. Attorney General, opened at the Senate Judiciary Committee today. NPR's Barbara Bradley says the opening statements gave a foretaste of how contentious the hearing will be.
Republican Senator Jeff Sessions captured the atmosphere of the hearing. John, he said, welcome to the pit. And from the start, it seemed that the battle lines were pretty well drawn. Chairman Patrick Leahy, a Democrat, said he was concerned that Ashcroft's personal beliefs about abortion, for example, would diminish his willingness to enforce the law. Leahy said the hearings are not about whether Ashcroft is anti-Catholic or anti-Mormon or anti-black.
Those of us who have worked with him in the Senate do not make that charge. But at the same time, I know that all senators and the nominee agree that no one nominated to be Attorney General should be given special treatment just because he or she once served in the Senate.
But Republicans said Ashcroft is the most qualified candidate in history. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
President Clinton issued the final budget of his presidency today. It projects that the nation will take in almost $2.5 trillion in non-Social Security surpluses over the next 10 years. Ari Fleischer, a spokesman for the incoming Bush administration, said Clinton's forecast was far higher than most private economists have predicted. President-elect Bush has said the economy needs his proposed $1.3 trillion tax cut if it's to remain healthy. Fleischer accused the Clinton administration of using excessive spending estimates to give the impression that there wouldn't be enough money left for the Bush tax cut. In his final budget message, President Clinton took credit for the economic boom, noting that his economic program passed in 1993 with no Republican votes. The White House says a small growth removed last week from President Clinton's back was cancerous. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
Doctors discovered the lesion last week during a routine medical checkup for the president at the Bethesda Naval Hospital. White House spokesman Jake Seward said tests show that the growth was a superficial basal cell skin cancer, the most common form of skin cancer. Seward said the spot appears to have been completely removed and that the chance of recurrence is low. Dr. David Corbett, the president's dermatologist, last week said that the growth did not pose a threat to the president's health. He said there are about 800,000 to a million new cases of the cancer in the United States each year. Corbett said the president has had other spots caused by sun damage, but that this one was the first one that looked suspicious. The president will be checked again by a dermatologist in about 4 to 6 months. Pam Fessler, NPR News. The White House.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 127 points, or 1.2%, to close at 10,652. This is NPR. The State Department has announced a reward of up to $5 million for information that leads to the arrest or conviction of people responsible for the bombing of the USS Cole. Spokesman Richard Boucher said the reward will be publicized in Yemen and other parts of the Middle East where people may have information about the attack. The suicide bombing in the port of Aden left 17 American sailors dead and 30 injured. New York's governor plans to appeal a judge's decision finding the state has shortchanged the students of New York City. Beth Fertig reports from member station WNYC in New York.
Governor George Pataki says he doesn't want a judge setting the funding formula for public education. He says that's up to the governor and the legislature. Last week, a judge found the state failed to provide a sound basic education for the 1 million students of New York City. He cited a shortage of certified teachers, severe overcrowding, and low graduation rates, and he ordered the legislature to come up with a new funding formula by mid-September. The suit was filed by the Campaign for Fiscal Equity, which argued that the city spends about $1,200 less per student than the statewide average. The group says it hopes the legislature will do the right thing while the case is appealed. Similar lawsuits have dragged on for years. Meanwhile, Governor Pataki just released his new budget proposal, but education advocates say it falls far short of what's needed. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak has publicly rejected two of the Palestinians' main demands. Barak said that Palestinian refugees and their descendants will never be allowed to return to Israel. The Prime Minister also said Israel will never give up control of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services and its employees working together in its Stop Hunger program on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Clinton is wrapping up his final week in the White House. Last week, we began a series of interviews with some of the people who served in the Clinton White House. Today, we hear from two press secretaries who had to deal with, among other things, the Monica Lewinsky scandal. We begin with Mike McCurry. He was the president's second press secretary, replacing Dede Meyers in 1995. McCurry resigned in 1998 and was replaced by his deputy press secretary, Joe Lockhart, at the beginning of the impeachment proceedings. We'll hear from Lockhart a little later. I asked Mike McCurry to describe the major stories that he dealt with.
Well, remember, I began in January of 95 and went through the balance of 1998, and though most will remember the Mike McCurry press secretary show as having to do mostly with Monica, in that same time, we really handled all the things that I think are sort of pivotal in understanding the Clinton presidency, the showdown with Newt Gingrich and the Republican Congress beginning in 1995, the effort to balance the budget consistent with some of President Clinton's overall federal budget priorities, the ongoing war in Bosnia, the awful incident of bombing in Oklahoma City at the Murrow Federal Office Building, really the kind of ongoing struggle to define what America's role in the post-Cold War era should be, which was dominated more than a bit of the briefing time that I had at the White House. So it was a calendar and a menu much fuller than that associated with the one episode that I think is kind of memorable, the Monica Lewinsky era.
Now, you took over from Clinton's first press secretary, Dede Meyers. What were the problems between the press and the Clinton White House when you took over?
Well, the relationship between the press and the presidency is always kind of a frosty one, but it lacked a little of the professionalism that I think needs to exist at the White House. There was not a great deal of respect on the part of the press for the young White House aides who worked in the press office and elsewhere, and correspondingly, there wasn't a lot of respect on the part of the White House and its staff for the press. I think there was some sense that this adversarial relationship was far less amicable than it needed to be for people to just kind of get on with business every day. So we made some effort early on in January 1995 and going forward to really restore some measure of civility in the relationship, even though it was never going to be a relationship of true love.
What were some of the changes you made?
I think just really responding more quickly and adeptly to inquiries, respecting the time of reporters who, of course, have to work on deadlines every day and face professional requirements, understanding that they're people, that they have creature needs, and that sometimes work at the White House is not very conducive to having a fun lifestyle. I think a lot of people would be surprised that White House beat for most reporters is far less glamorous than one might imagine. Lots of early morning pool duties, lots of late night travel to get from one place to the next, and not nearly as much fun as a lot of people would think.
Creature needs are what? Food, bathrooms, and chairs?
Yeah, food and drink, primarily, and sleep when available.
Now, did you try to talk to either the president or other members of the administration about how to improve relations with the press?
I did, and I got a commitment both from the president, from Mrs. Clinton, and from others to really try to do a little bit better job of respecting the needs and the time of reporters. And I think, by and large, we did pretty well. We couldn't always accommodate the schedules of reporters. We probably weren't always as forthcoming or as useful with information as we needed to be. But I think we began to improve the flow of information that went from the White House to the American people. Ultimately, the White House and the press probably care about the same thing, which is getting as much good information in the hands of the American people. The press, because that's their job. The White House, because I think they believe that if you can get information about what you're doing into the hands of the American people, they will believe that what you're doing is right. So I try to build on what, at least in theory, should be some common interest between both sides of this adversarial relationship.
One of your conditions for taking the job as press secretary was that there had to be another press contact for Whitewater. Why didn't you want to deal with Whitewater?
Well, it would be very easy for the White House to kind of mimic the news organizations that were pursuing the Whitewater matter. One of my old bosses, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, is fond of saying that organizations in conflict become like one another, and it would have been very easy for us to just get sucked into doing nothing but Whitewater all the time. But I recognize this, that all of the news organizations pursuing Whitewater and related subjects had specialists, had investigative reporters and others who were focusing only on that matter. And I said, well, why doesn't the White House respond in kind by creating a place where those questions can be dealt with, but dealt with sort of offline, away from the press briefing room, away from, you know, the other work that needed to be done to understand what the day-to-day work of the White House was about. And I think that worked satisfactorily. The other thing was we had a good group of lawyers and then recruited lawyers who could serve the function of being press spokesmen for the team that was really working on that particular set of issues. So you had people who could work with the confidence of the lawyers and the attorneys who are on the Whitewater matter, and I think that led to more professional treatment of some of the media inquiries that came in.
Well, it sounds like a smart and clever approach, and it got Whitewater off your hands, but then you got Monica. Did you ask the president to tell you whatever he could, or did you want to know as little as possible?
Well, I think I wanted to know as much as possible, but I also recognized that if I walked into the Oval Office and said to the president, what's the deal with you and this young lady, he would have then forfeited his right to have confidential communications with attorneys. You know, the president, it was often said during the whole Lewinsky matter, is not above the law, but the truth is he's not beneath the law either. He had certain rights, and obviously one of them was to confer in private with his attorneys and to really get some sense of how to shape a defense to what was, after all, a very aggressive and determined prosecution aimed at his direction. So we had to labor in the very peculiar circumstance of referring back to lawyers, referring to statements that had been drafted for the president by his attorneys, and really not budge much beyond that set of parameters that we were given for response.
Now, your approach during the Monica Lewinsky story was to say what the president said and say that the president said so-and-so and not offer your own opinions. Why was that your approach, and can you give us an example of how you'd phrase an answer?
Well, I think the reason for that, and that was my approach, because I didn't know anything. I, in the great words of the character from Stalag 17 or whatever the show was, I knew nothing. and I kind of remained in that state of not knowing by design, on purpose, for the reasons I said. But it was very important to me not to do anything that would make matters worse. I think White Houses, when they face scandal or crisis, very often start dissembling. And that usually ends up putting everyone in a worse spot than if they just stuck to what they knew for sure to be true. What I knew for sure was that I'd been handed a piece of paper that had the words on it crafted very carefully by lawyers, and I wasn't going to budge from that statement. And I think in a lot of different ways I managed to say I'm not going to parse this statement further, which was very interesting. I heard from a lot of English teachers around the country saying, oh, thank goodness someone remembers what the discipline of parsing sentences is all about.
So what press conference was the worst ordeal for you?
Well, the worst ordeals were those things that dealt with real tragedy, not farce. Monica was mostly farce. Tragedy was when Ron Brown died tragically in on a mission to Bosnia, when we saw that awful explosion at the Muro office building in Oklahoma City, when we saw the devastation and the ethnic cleansing that came to dominate life for those living in the Balkans. Those were the things that were truly awful to deal with, because the United States of America, for all of its greatness in the world, couldn't control things like that. And dealing with death and dealing with that kind of tragedy, where I think was the hardest personally to deal with, particularly in a case when it's someone that you knew and respected and had a great fondness for, like Secretary Brown.
But in a situation like that, the really hard part is the fact of what happened, as
right.
opposed to questions that you're being asked that you have to strategize a way to deal with and maybe dodge.
Well, that's the natural instinct of press secretaries, to bob and weave, but to deal with the raw gut emotion when you feel it and keep your professionalism and keep your sense of, keep the sense of being circumspect about these things that otherwise would cause you turmoil. I mean, that personally was very, very hard to do, to not get over emotional on the podium.
Getting back to the ordeal question, let me ask you specifically of from the Monica era, which press conference was the worst ordeal?
Oh, I mean, they all kind of, now, it's a long time ago now, they all sort of run together.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like for a period there in January of 1998, it was, it was mostly just this kind of almost comic soap opera every day. And in fact, it was pretty much soap opera, and I don't think one was any more memorable than the next.
Well, you say comic. I mean, you were often very funny.
Well, by design. I mean, if you didn't have information and didn't have anything that you could use by way of an answer, you ought to do something, at least entertain the masses.
What jokes got the best reaction?
The ones that were carefully designed in advance. I think the line that was memorable, that frankly was not mine, and we came up with in advance of a briefing, was because you knew what the circumstance would be, I wouldn't be able to really say much of anything. I kind of looked aside at one point to my staff and said, I feel like I'm double parked in a no comment zone.
So you didn't write that? Who wrote it?
It was like, I think we sat around just sort of, I begged my staff, let's sit here with me and come up with some clever one-liners that will get me off the stage sooner rather than later.
Do you think the reporters empathized a bit?
Yeah, I think they understood. I mean, they didn't enjoy covering the story any more than I enjoyed answering the questions about it. The White House press corps consists of some of the best journalists anywhere in the world, people who know incredible amounts of things, who are capable of covering foreign policy, domestic policy, popular culture. They really are some of the best in the business, and to be reduced to sort of chasing this particular story day after day after day with seeming no end was, I think, very frustrating to the press.
Did the Monica story put a strain on your relationship with the president, because there were things that he couldn't really tell you, there were things that you were probably better off not knowing, and he was under such a great strain, and you were under such a great strain? Did that strain manifest itself in your relationship as well?
I think everybody was under strain, but everybody knew that we had to get our jobs done and had to stay focused on what mattered most, and it was not questions about Monica, it was the things that the president was elected to do, and that if, as long as we stayed focused on that and let our energy go into the work that we had to do, that things would hopefully come out all right in the end.
Now, the president did his best to stay focused on issues he was working on. What about you? Was it possible for you to stay focused on those issues at press conferences?
I walked into the briefing every day with a big, fat, black book filled with things that I think that we had anticipated there'd be lots of questions about, because there were things going on in government or around the world that might require some comment from the White House. And I think every day I walked out somewhat surprised and really, in a sense, concerned that so little of the questioning had ever gotten off to another matter.
My guest is Mike McCurry. He was the White House press secretary from 1995 to 98. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mike McCurry is my guest. He was the White House press secretary from 1995 to 98. You were the first press secretary to handle all briefings on television. How does it change things when you're doing it on TV?
In retrospect, I don't know whether I would have made that change, because it does change the dynamic of the briefing. It creates way too many instances in which I think journalists have to posture for the cameras, or at least for the, you know, their editor somewhere may be watching their performance just as they're looking for the answers from the podium. So it kind of creates more tension in the briefing room than I think needs to exist. And there probably has to be a better way to really get good information in the hands of reporters so they can report on what's happening.
You were press secretary during one of the most partisan moments in recent American history, and I'm wondering if the partisan nature of what was happening in Congress affected the kinds of questions you were getting asked by the press. Do you think that the press was getting partisan at the same time?
I think there was a lot of partisanship in Washington, and it's the way in which we deal with information overload sometimes, the fact that there's so much news all the time, 24/7, running nonstop, that the only context for understanding a storyline is to make it all black and white. It's us versus them. It's the Democrats versus Republicans. And so everything gets turned into sort of verbal mud wrestling. And I plead guilty to that. I think probably I injected way too much partisanship into the commentary at the White House. And in the end, I think Americans appreciate it when they just get as much solid, good information as possible. And they like it when they see people trying to work out differences rather than exacerbating differences. And so I'm not so sure that any of us serve the American public well by being that partisan. Marlon Fitzwater, one of my predecessors, once told me that anytime you were standing at the podium and you were talking about the opposition leaders in Congress, you could probably be pretty certain that you were on very dangerous terrain. And I think that was good advice on his part.
What did he mean by that?
I think he meant that if you're not, as a government spokesman, as a spokesman for the White House, you can get too political, that it's really up to those who work in campaigns and those who represent our political parties to do the business of politics, that the presidency has to be about doing the people's business at the end of the day. And we're one of the only countries on the face of the earth where the spokesman for the leader has both a political role and an official capacity as a government employee. And most other democracies, that job is split between the spokesman for the political party and then maybe the spokesman for the prime minister or the president, who has more of an official role. And in our political culture, we've blended those two roles in the person of the press secretary, and that might be something that we want to rethink.
Now, I want to just ask you briefly about a real turning point for the Clinton presidency, and that's when Clinton refused to sign the Republican budget, and the government was shutting down, and Clinton wasn't going to budge. And so the Republicans finally had to back off. It was really important for you as press secretary to put out the right interpretation of this, to give your story a positive spin and not a negative one. Tell me a little bit about how you handled that and the importance for you of using the right language and figuring out how you were going to frame the story for the press.
Well, it's interesting because that's an instance in which I think I didn't exactly do the job the way the president wanted, because I tended to be a little too partisan. I tended to paint the story as our budget's better than theirs, and here's why. And I think the president felt that I might have been a little too sharp and too partisan in the way I spoke about Speaker Gingrich and about the Republican majority in Congress. He very frequently sort of dialed me down a little bit and told me to not get out there as far as we got sometimes. The reason was simple. He was, doing the very careful business of trying to negotiate with those same Republicans, and he knew that they were watching very carefully what the White House said on his behalf. And I think he wanted us to be very, very careful, because at the end, he was the guy that got elected, not any of us. And he was the one that wanted to be in the position to actually try to compromise or negotiate the deal, and he didn't want to have a lot of public statements out there that would complicate his job. So I think we had to be careful. At the same time, we were getting ready. We were in a desperately important political fight. Probably in a way, the the most important political fight of the Clinton presidency, and it was important for us to prevail because we believed in the values and the priorities that we were defending. But I think there is a very careful line to walk, and it's hard to get it right all the time. And I think that's when you have to be exceedingly sure that you're reflecting exactly what the president himself once said, because, again, he's the one that counts, not the staff.
So would you usually have meetings with the president after press conferences to go over your performance?
I'd hear about it if he wasn't satisfied with the performance. I mean, we didn't do a debrief because, frankly, the president didn't have enough time to watch my briefings every day. But if something went wrong, he usually very quickly knew about it.
What do you think that President Clinton should be most remembered for?
Well, I think in time he is going to be remembered most for the growth of the Internet and the changes that have occurred in our economy and communications technologies. In 20 years from now, I doubt anyone will, you know, they might remember who Monica Lewinsky is. They'll probably remember that Bill Clinton got impeached, but they'll be a little vague on the circumstances. What they will remember for sure is at the end of the 20th century in the late 1990s, this thing called the Internet really took off, developed, became a real factor in the lives of the American people. And I've got to believe that in time, those changes in technology and in our society are going to be much clearer, and they will be associated with Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton will get some of the credit that he rightfully deserves for having created the conditions that those changes could occur.
When you left the White House, what advice did you give your successor, Joe Lockhart?
When I left, I was dead wrong about everything. I said to him, Joe, you're going to have a good 2 years here to really help promote the president's agenda, because the Democrats are going to do well in the midterm election in 1998, and of course the Republicans are going to drop impeachment and never go on with that. So just remember to stay focused on all those things that we were talking about during the 1996 re-election campaign, and you'll be home free. It ended up being exactly wrong.
Right. Mike McCurry, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mike McCurry was the White House press secretary from 1995 to 98. He's now the CEO of Grassroots.com. Later we'll hear from his successor in the White House, Joe Lockhart. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Holland America, offering cruises to destinations worldwide, including the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, Alaska, and Europe, on the web at hollandamerica.com. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Edith Story, The True Story of One Girl's Courage and Survival During World War II by Edith Vellmans. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, taking over as press secretary at the start of the impeachment trial, we talk with Joe Lockhart, White House press secretary from late 1998 to late 2000, and Ken Tucker reviews the new album by country singer Alan Jackson. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joe Lockhart took over from Mike McCurry as White House press secretary just in time for a White House nightmare, the impeachment. Lockhart was White House press secretary from October of 98 to October 2000. In addition to the impeachment, he handled such stories as the bombing of Kosovo and the custody battle for Elian Gonzalez. Lockhart had been McCurry's deputy press secretary. I asked Lockhart to describe what happened the day he took over as press secretary.
The day I took over turned out to be the first day of the official impeachment. It was the day the House Judiciary Committee held their first formal hearing on the subject. So in addition to going up and standing in front of the cameras at the White House with a somewhat hostile press corps, there was actually an important piece of news that day. So, I mean, I like to describe my first briefing as an out-of-body experience because through most of it, I felt like I was standing 4 feet to my side watching me screw it up. You know, as with anything, after you do it a couple times, you get a little more comfortable. And I think we all at the White House got more comfortable in that fight as it proceeded. Because, you know, I think we knew that the public was generally on our side, that the Republican leadership was pushing things too far and too hard.
Looking back, do you think you did screw up during that first press conference?
Oh, probably not. I mean, I think the president said to me some months later, and I took it as a compliment, something along the lines of, you know, it's really nice that you've lost that deer in the headlights look. And you know, so I think there was an element of that. There was an element of sort of establishing my own credential with the press corps to be able to speak authoritatively for the president. And that was all of those things are natural for anyone coming in new. This was just accentuated a little bit, actually not a little bit, a lot, by the fact that we were beginning the formal impeachment proceedings.
Did you and the president advise each other on how to handle the press, how to talk to the press during the impeachment?
Well, we had a constant back and forth. So the answer would be yes, but it would also be yes on a number of other subjects, including policy. Truth be told, we both did a little bit of listening and a little bit of ignoring. Because if I did everything the president thought I should do during that time, I don't think I would have been effective. But he certainly had insights from time to time that were quite helpful. And the same is true, I think, of him. I would give him advice on a daily basis, which issues to talk about, which were best ignored or left alone. And there were certainly many days that he took my advice, and I think things worked out better. But there were certainly days when he ignored my advice, and it's, you know, kind of a mixed bag of, you know, whether it was better or worse.
Were there lessons that you feel you learned during the Monica part of the story that preceded the actual impeachment, lessons you learned by handling part of that story yourself and by watching how your predecessor as press secretary, Mike McCurry, had handled it?
Well, you know, I think I learned lessons about that I was able to put into practice when I took the job about being sure, about being skeptical of incomplete information and trying to really get at the bottom and have several people confirm to me the facts of any given story or any given accusation that was made. And that was difficult during the investigative part of this saga. But I think that is what I took most and probably learned most in the time that I worked as the deputy under Mike McCurry.
Well, what's an example of a story where you didn't have as many sources as you should have and the information was wrong and you didn't realize it?
Well, there's one story that it's not an important story as far as this case or anything or even the government. But, you know, it was a weekend and there was a question about whether the lawyers for the president had ever retained a private investigator because there was a controversy about the independent counsel spending, I think, upwards of $1 million on private investigators. And It was a weekend where Mike worked on a Saturday and I worked on a Sunday. And on Saturday, the reporters who asked got one answer. On Sunday, they got a different answer. And the difference was Mike was smart enough to ask the right questions and push a little bit harder than I pushed to get a completely accurate answer. And so, you know, it was a it was an example of having to do the work. And secondly, what's really damaging, I think, to people who try to do this as a press secretary is that sometimes you ask a question and you want the answer to be a certain way. And when you're in that position, you can hear the answer the way you want to hear it. And that's something that I learned that weekend, learned particularly from Mike, about, you know, don't presume the answer. Don't have an answer you want. Just go get the answer.
So what was the difference between the information you got and the information McCurry got?
His was a, yes, but. You know, it's not like what has been reported that the independent counsel had done. Mine was, I had asked the question just so, you know, are we doing what they're doing? And the answer was no, of course we're not doing what they're doing. So I said no, we're not employing private investigators. And it was an answer, you know, I didn't feel misled by the person. I felt like I hadn't done the work properly to get the right, to get at the truth and the proper answer. And it was, the reason that it was so stark for me was, both of us went at this not knowing the other one was doing it, and he just did a better job on it.
So did you give the wrong information to the public?
I did, and I owned it, and, had to, stand up Monday morning and say that, I gave the wrong information, and it was my fault.
And what are the consequences of that?
Well, you don't go to jail, but a press secretary is only as good as their credibility, and something like that does not help your credibility. It's not terminal. The reporters didn't stand up and say, we're not going to believe another word you say. I had a track record with this group for 2 years, and I think they understood that sometimes we make mistakes. If their preconception or if their experience with me was that I was fast and loose with the truth, it would have been a much more serious event for me personally.
Is there an example of a statement you made or the way you handled a turn in the impeachment story that you think was particularly effective in framing the story?
Well, I'll give you one that may seem trivial, but to me it was an important one. And this was near the end where, I think we had beaten back the charge of impeachment and it looked like it was finally going to die under its own weight in the Senate. And immediately there was a groundswell of concern and stories about, well, will the White House be doing, a celebratory dance and will they gloat? And, I heard this for 2 days in a row from the reporters and just, out of nowhere, just decided and said and unilaterally declared that post-impeachment the White House would be a gloat-free zone. And I, sort of took some heat from that inside about being so glib, but it actually... Like many things here in town, it's not what happens. It's the lead-up and the anticipation, and it sort of took the issue off the table. That's a small sort of anecdotal. I think to answer the larger question, every single day of the impeachment battle, I felt my challenge was to frame this as a political power issue. That the Republicans were doing this because they had political differences with the president and were exercising their political power. And I think, by and large, that is the way the public or the majority of the public ultimately viewed this. And that is one of the reasons that the president, enjoyed increasing support through this rather than decreasing support.
My guest is former White House Press Secretary Joe Lockhart. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joe Lockhart is my guest, and he was the White House press secretary during the impeachment. He was the press secretary from October of 98 through October of 2000. Well, shortly after the impeachment, you had to handle the story of the bombing in Kosovo.
Yeah, I mean, people ask me what was the hardest thing that I had to do during my tenure as White House press secretary. And I think they don't believe me when I say it wasn't impeachment. And I think they think I'm just trying to put it on something that ended better or was more favorable for the president. But it really wasn't impeachment, because impeachment was a raw political battle, which from a communications point of view, we were in a pretty good position to fight. Kosovo was much more difficult. This was something that was very important. Most of us felt very strongly that it was the right thing to do. And we did a miserable job initially of convincing people that what we were doing was right and that it was going to work. And there were a lot of reasons for that. One is that this wasn't like the Gulf War, where you had the ability to show what you were doing. We were doing this in a place where Milosevic had control of state television there, had control of all the pictures, so really could dictate the storyline out of there. We had a really unprecedented political environment here in Washington, where from even before we started, there was not the general bipartisan support for a military action. There was partisan sniping that started even before we started. And there was, within the military, people who did not believe that an air campaign alone would work. They argued that strongly internally, and many of them argued it anonymously and just as strongly in the newspapers externally. So there was a real challenge there that and very frustrating, because we knew what we were doing was right. We were reasonably certain what we were doing would work, but almost from the moment that it started, it faced very deep skepticism.
Now, you were press secretary during the Elian Gonzalez story, and everyone remembers the pictures of the agents with guns taking Elian away from his relatives. It is one of the most spun photos of the recent past. What were some of the problems that photo presented for you?
Well, this was a situation where the White House had generally stayed out of the Elian Gonzalez issue, allowing Justice and INS to do it. When it became a super overheated political problem, there was a point where the White House could not stay out of it, and I think it was our view, and we expressed it internally within the justice system, that if the family wouldn't cooperate, the boy would have to be taken and returned under circumstances that would be controversial. That was all done that morning, about 5 a.m. in the morning, and was done safely with no one hurt. And in fact, in many ways, it was a flawless operation. And from about 5 till 7 in the morning, we were feeling pretty good about it until that picture came out. And that picture completely changed the dynamic of that morning, because no matter how right we knew we were, no matter how much the law supported and what we thought, your basic family rights supported what we were doing, that picture did more and told a far different story than anything we could do or say. So the story changed a couple hours later in the day when the lawyers for the Gonzalez family released a series of pictures showing the young boy with his father in very pleasant and happy setting. So it really exposed one more time how important a visual image is and how it can drown out even the most compelling of stories, whether it be based on the law or based on what's right versus what's wrong.
Did you put out the word, we need a photo that will make this decision look good, to counter the photo of the agents with guns?
Well, let's just say, in my conversations with the Justice Department, I asked the question, because it was important for me to know, is the boy safe? Is he happy? Are things going well there? Is he happy to be back with his father? And the answer to all those questions for hours, hour after hour, was yes, because they had people there, the marshals were there, and I was trying to help coordinate how the marshals would get out and talk to the media. That was all good information, and it would be nice to be able to say, but it was something that you would ultimately have to visually show. So I think you know, it was one of those weird things where, you know, if I could have gone to where they were and brought a camera with me, I would have. But you had even the television anchors sort of openly saying, you know, it would really be nice if we had a picture of what was going on. So, you know, it took a while for them to pull all it together. It was a, you know, it's an example of how, you know, words are important, but visual images can trump even the best composed argument.
Joe Lockhart is my guest. He was White House press secretary from October of 98 to October of 2000. You would often joke with the press at briefings. Did any of your jokes ever get you into trouble?
Occasionally. You know, I made a joke. One of the first things I did after I was announced as the new press secretary is I missed a flight. And I made a joke about it at the expense of the president. And
what'd you say?
You know, it was during the period where he had said something quite serious about you know, trying to make up for the damage he had done to his family during this period. And I sort of used those words to talk about the, you know, the damage I had done in missing the plane. Something that the reporters all thought was hilarious. I don't think the president thought it was that funny. You don't get in trouble in the sense that you actually, you know, someone comes and tells you to go sit in the corner. You just, you realize afterwards that, boy, that probably wasn't the smartest thing to do. And you learn from it. It's, you know, it's a fine line. You know, humor is probably the best, one of the best weapons you can use in sort of disarming a aggressive press corps. It's particularly useful when you can do it at your own expense rather than someone else's expense. But there are times when, you know, in trying to loosen things up, that you go a little bit over the line, and you know, you generally have to pay for those.
What are your impressions so far of how the Bush campaign is speaking with the media?
Oh, you know, it's hard to judge when you're in this sort of phony period of transition. They will ultimately fail or succeed on their ability to articulate clearly what they're doing, provide solid information, provide enough information about what the government's doing and where they want to take the country. That's not what's going on now. You know, I think that the biggest thing that they face is understanding the difference between being in a campaign and being in government, and the fact that in a campaign you're trying to win a rhetorical battle, and a government you're actually dealing with facts and you're dealing with things that succeed and fail. And I think the people who do the best are the ones that can acknowledge their failures, but highlight their successes in a way that builds support. But it really is a very different challenge than what a communicator tries to do in a campaign.
One last question. Because the press secretary now is on TV all the time, holding briefings, you become something of a celebrity yourself. And I'm wondering, when strangers meet you in the street and recognize you, what are the one or two things that they most often say to you about yourself or about the president?
The odd thing is that most people who you come up to in the street think they know you but don't know why they know you. They think that you went to high school or college with them. And there's a lot of them are very surprised when you tell them, you know, well, this is why you know me. The ones that do recognize you, generally 95% of them are self-selected positive people who will tell you that they enjoyed your work or they love the president. There's very few people who come up and are nasty. But I think the overwhelming response over the last year, at least, or the overwhelming question is, and it, no matter where I am in the country, I get this, is, what do you think of CJ, and is West Wing realistic? And luckily for CJ and West Wing, I think she's great, and I like the show, so I tell them that.
Well, it tells you something about television, doesn't it, that you could be the press secretary during impeachment, but what people really want to know is, what's CJ like?
Well, it is an amazing thing that I believe that the press secretary's job has fundamentally changed since cameras were introduced, and they're now covered all the time. It has really changed the nature of the briefing. It's increased the importance of the job through visibility. There's this very strange phenomenon in America where you can be a Nobel Prize scientist and say something and no one really cares, or you can be someone like me, and because I say it on television, they really think you know what you're talking about. And I mean, there's something that's probably wrong about that, but it's just the nature of our culture that we glorify that we see on, you know, whether it's a 19-inch or 35-inch box in our living room.
Well, Joe Lockhart, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joe Lockhart was the White House press secretary from October of 98 to October 2000. He's now part of the senior management team at the software company Oracle. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by country singer Alan Jackson. This is Fresh Air. During 1999's Country Music Association award show, singer Alan Jackson surprised the show's producers by making a last-minute change and singing a then-current George Jones song called Choices. A multi-platinum-selling artist himself, Jackson was protesting the fact that country radio stations were ignoring veterans like Jones in favor of slicker acts like Faith Hill and Garth Brooks. But rock critic Ken Tucker says Jackson's new CD, When Somebody Loves You, turns Jackson's rebellion into its own kind of self-defeating gesture.
I like my steak well done, taters fried, football games on Monday night. It's just who I am, a meat and potato man. I like my coffee black, old TV shows, my women hot and my beer ice cold. It's just who I am, a meat and potato man.
We have reached the point in the history of country music where a traditionalist like Alan Jackson sounds like a parody of himself. 10 years ago, I probably would have been hailing a Jackson CD like When Somebody Loves You as a fine example of country classicism, a glorious throwback. But context changes pop music, and after literally dozens of would-be throwback masterpieces from artists as various as the Bakersfield punching bag Dwight Yoakam, and neglected songwriters like Rodney Crowell and Jim Lauderdale, throwing back to the golden age of 50s and 60s country can often seem like just another way of giving up.
I know you're leaving, I see the signs. You're gonna walk out on this heart of mine. You'll never call me, you'll never write. You made your mind up and you're gone tonight. If some rainy day you're all alone, you feel like talking, you can lock me home at www.memory. I'll be waiting for you.
I'm not sure which is more annoying, a sincerely bland, earnest sellout like, say, Faith Hill, or Alan Jackson's knowing novelty recordings like that one called www.memory. There's something so insular about Jackson's stance, a preachment to the converted even when the congregation consists of millions of intelligent fans, that renders his self-styled rebellion against the Nashville establishment a neutered gesture.
It's all right to be a redneck. It's all right to ride around in a dirty old truck, catch a bunch of fish and shoot a bunch of duck. It's all right to be a redneck, chase around the girls on Friday night. You wanna make them feel all right. It's all right.
It's all right.
It's all right.
It's all right.
It's all right to be a redneck.
Now, you know that Alan Jackson doesn't really think it's all right to be a redneck. Just the way he describes the subculture, you know he thinks it's beneath him. It isn't rednecks that help him go multi-platinum. It's people who think rednecks are exotic people it's okay to snicker at. About a year ago, Jackson teamed up with another traditionalist, George Strait, to cut a song called Murder on Music Row, which deplored the pop influence on country music. On his new CD, Jackson's criticisms get even more heavy-handed on another novelty tune whose title is supposed to tell us what Nashville record companies want from their clients. It's called 3-Minute Positive Not Too Country Up-Tempo Love Song.
This is a 3-minute song to tell her that I love her, how wonderful we get along. The sweet sentiment is borderline slick, a lot of right and not much wrong. It's a little bit edgy, but softer than spaghetti, weak yet redundantly strong. It's a 3-minute positive, not too country up tempo love song. Yeah, it's a 3-minute positive, not too country up tempo love song. It's a way for me to tell her that I love her, but it can't be too long. There'll be no drinking, no cheating, no lying, no leaving. That stuff, it just don't belong in a 3-minute positive, not too country up tempo love song.
Here we go. I guess I'd be more enthusiastic about Jackson's efforts if his CD contained any flash of music that didn't play to his audience's expectations. He's managed to tame rebellion so that it sounds as trite as the music he's reacting against.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Alan Jackson's new CD, When Somebody Loves You. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharuk directs the show. I'm Jerry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the state of American politics with Bill Bradley, former presidential candidate, U.S. senator, and pro basketball star. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.